And some of them approached to see first maybe making a contribution of this bank building, which houses the present museum, as a gift to the Historical Society so we could bring this into fruition. And so CFIRST did it, and they gave us this building and had a beautiful bronze plaque made to fasten on the building. And we started collecting artifacts. We put out anybody that had artifacts that they either liked to loan or contribute, that we would be receptive to them. And there was guys like Terry Cox and Sim Beeson and Jim Linston and there's many, many people that I could recount for quite a while, people that made contributions to it. Mm-hmm. And each year we would set up an annual meeting, and we'd bring in somebody that was very familiar with the mm-hmm. with the area to talk and tell about things of the past. Stella Wooten was one of the people that gave one of the most interesting talks of all. Mrs. Fort, Harold Fort at Manson, did a terrific job, and there were guys like Ms. Newt Griffith. Newt told about the early days of the reclamation area and how the project came into being. A lot of people didn't know that this Mr. Green, that was headed the bank for many years, a very, very famous man, lived to be over 100 years old. I'm trying to recall his first name, but he and his wife were early sponsors, investors of the reclamation deal at Manson. Mr. Ray, Harry Ray, he put the state of Washington in the apple business back during the Depression years. It looked like we were going to have to pull all the orchards out of Manson because they weren't be able to pay the water assessments and expand the irrigation district and so forth. And if I remember right, Governor Hartley was then in the office of governor. Harry Ray was a very shrewd businessman, a financial expert, I would think. And he went over and convinced the governor that the state of Washington ought to be in the apple business. And from that, they were able to get finance and assistance to keep from having to pull out the apple trees and help mm-hmm. finance the district and keep it in a viable position, in which we know that the Manson area, probably there's no finer area in the world for producing apples. I mean, I think the Lake Chelan area apples are always the top priced apple on the New York and Chicago, yeah. Dallas markets. And
Dave, have you always been interested in history?
Always been interested in history. My family goes back on my father's side to the Civil War. My grandfather, Freeman Franklin, knew Abraham Lincoln very well. We were very good friends. And Freeman was a chaplain. He was a Methodist minister, circuit riding preacher in Iowa for many years, but he was a chaplain in the Illinois Army, or Illinois Regiment, and division, I guess you'd call it. And my grandfather, Francis Flournoy, or Frank Flournoy, was a Confederate soldier, and it was six boys in his family, and three fought with the North. No, I got backwards. Three fought for the South, two fought for the North, and the sixth boy come out and started the town of Alturas, California, just prior to the Civil War. My folks came to Washington in 1900 and settled out in the Horse Heavens, and all the family, all the boys, took homesteads out in the Horse Heavens south of Mabton, looking down on the Columbia River, looking over into Oregon. Yeah. Tremendous area.
I'm an old Civil War buff. Have the records of your ancestors in the Civil War survived at all? Do you have family letters and things like that?
Well, to some extent. Now, the family, most of the family back in, I still have a lot of family back in Missouri. And when I was back in Missouri, in Kansas City, last spring, I called up a man named Emmett Flournoy, who was named after my uncle Emmett Flournoy. And he told me many things about it that I hadn't known. He said, for instance, did you know that the old Flournoy home is across the street from the Truman Library, and it's on the historical register? He said, and did you know that Jesse James hid out on your grandfather's farm at Kearney, Missouri? And he said he took four horses when he was running from the law, and he said he took four horses and he left a bag of gold. He didn't steal them. He left a bag of gold and to place them. And he said, but your grandfather knew Jesse James, which many people in that area did at that time, because Jesse James was considered quite a hero back in those in Missouri in those days. He was on the Confederate side, you see, and Missouri was a very divided state.
Several of the guys who came to be famous Union generals actually had contact here in the Washington State area. George
That's right.
McClellan came up. Of course, Governor Stevens, Isaac Stevens, was killed early in the war.
General Sherman.
Yeah. Kind of a sense of irony there about, and these fellows were here basically in the 1850s, most of them, and sort of preceded the veterans who came out and settled the area later. In your own family history in the Civil War, did you have a chance to talk with either of your grandfathers about their experiences at all?
Oh, yeah. His grandfather, Francis Flournoy, he never went any place without he took his old campaign hat and his musket. And he visited us in Pocatello, Idaho, in 1915. He didn't live too many years after that, but I've heard him tell about his being taken prisoner and being in Lincoln Prison, and he said sometimes he'd kick an old crust of bread around for a week, and then he said we'd fight like hell. He said who got to eat it, and then he was telling about one time on a foraging party in the mountains of Tennessee. I think it was out of Gatlinburg, he said that they came up to and approached this family in the hills if they had any potatoes or onions or so forth. No, they didn't have any potatoes. And did they have any onions? No, they didn't have any onions. And he said he could see there was a puzzled look on this girl of about 15 years old. And he said as he left, he heard the girl turn to her mother and said, Ma, I bet that damn fool meant ingerns. They didn't call them onions. They called them ingerns.
Yeah.
And down south, you don't say coal oil when you're talking about kerosene, they call it curloil.
Mm-hmm.
And these are some of the things that I remember my grandfather and so forth telling about.
Here in the Lake Chelan Valley, I think there was a Civil War veteran here who had been a drummer boy, and in 1937 or 39, he went back to Gettysburg for a reunion. I think the community even raised some funds to send him back with a traveling companion and so on. Do you remember that at all?
No, I vaguely remember hearing about this, but I can't right now recall his name, and maybe you would know his name.
I'm trying to think of it, and I can't.
Yeah.
But you know what it does to me, Dave, is it illustrates how young our history really is.
That's right.
We look upon something like the Civil War as being something that doesn't even affect us anymore. And
that's right.
Without getting into a lecture here, it certainly does, even today.
Yes.
But you know that we have people like yourself who say, "Yeah, I talked to my grandfather about Civil War experiences," and sort of brings it all together, doesn't it?
Well, I talk to the Flournoy family every year in Northern California. They have a Flournoy gathering. The Flournoy family goes back to the Revolutionary War. Robert Flournoy was a general in George Washington's army, and Joseph Flournoy was a very famous doctor in Kentucky. He went to Transylvania University and was considered quite a famous doctor, but Houston Flournoy recently, who ran for governor against Jimmy Brown, kid, and lost. He was comptroller general from many, many years of the state of California. And I met his family, because of Flournoy name and so forth. And they told me a lot about the family. This old George Flournoy, the father of Houston Flournoy, said that he wanted to know which was my grandfather. And I told him, and he said, my father saw the Civil War coming and got out of there and came out to Alturas, California, and he said, California's been awful good to us. They owned sawmills and flour mills and hardware stores, and they owned a big motel called the Frontier now. It used to be the Flournoy, Flournoy Motel, but it was quite interesting to pick up this part of the Flournoy
sure.
family.
Sure.
They were French Huguenots, came over after the St. Bartholomew Day's Massacre, and 15 was it 82 that and they grandfather Laurent Flournoy went to Switzerland, and then they speared him out. He was supposed to get his head chopped off in the St. Bartholomew
Massacre.
Yeah. And he came to Switzerland and then to Virginia before, well, about 1600 when Laurent Flournoy came to.
You're fortunate to know these things about your family. Most of us don't have that information, you know, that
yeah,
we can call up on the
I
top
I have the
right.
history of the family back to 1550 and on the Flournoy side and back to England on my father's side.
Yeah. Dave, I know you've spent a lot of time in recent years going over the history of the Lake Chelan area, and we'll talk about that primarily this morning. But first, let's take a commercial break, and we'll come back in just a moment. Live from the Crockery on this, the last day of the month of Heritage for 1983. Dave, in the Lake Chelan Valley, I know that you have prepared presentations over the years to give to various groups and so on about sort of general history in this area, and some of those things, areas are things that we covered 6 years ago when we started and haven't really gone back to since. The earliest white contact in this area, where did it come from? Was it miners? Was it folks just traveling through, the old mountain men who...
Well, there were two men, Saunders and Dumpke. They heard about this Lake Chelan area when they were up north. Now, a lot of people don't realize it, but civilization didn't come in from the south into the Lake Chelan area. It came in from the north, from up around Oroville and Asuyas and up across the line in Canada. Many of the people that came in from the north. And these two men, Henry Dumpke and Alan, and they came, they heard about this Lake Chelan country, and they got a pack horse, went up the Matthau Valley, crossed the divide, and they tried to descend to the lake down a creek called Prince Creek, but it was an awful wild area. And in the process, their horse fell off the bluff and was killed. Well, then they lost most of their supplies. They did salvage their guns and an axe, and they finally found the creek that they came down, which was later called Canoe Creek. Mm-hmm. And at Canoe Creek, they got a big log, hollowed it out with chopping and burning, and made them a crude canoe, and whittled out some oars, and descended to the foot of the lake. And
is it true that Prince Creek was named after their horse and Canoe Creek was named because they built a canoe there?
That's right. That's absolutely correct. Everything I've read, do you go back to the early Chelan leader, the early papers and so forth, and DeWitt Britt and those people, and this is true. This is where it came into being. And the Indians convinced these two gentlemen that they ought to file on land here. And they did. But Henry Dumpke, he wanted to get ahead in the world, and he went down to Portland and arranged for all the equipment to build a sawmill. And he built the first sawmill in the area at Dumpke Falls there.
Do you get the same feeling I do, Dave, when you read about these fellows and say, who were those guys?
Yeah, I do. I do.
Is there any information about where these fellows came from, why in the world they were out here in Washington in the first place or anything like that?
Well, I think that we were going through a period in history when everything was on the move. People were coming west. They were looking to make a stake. Some of them wanted to buy mining. Others were interested in establishing homes for new homes. And young men that were out footloose wanting to get ahead in the world. And we know that these men did carve out a future for himself. There were guys like the Smith family here. We recently was a man by the name of Park Smith. He passed away several years ago, and their father, Ben Smith, was one of the early day settlers in here and built a home on the lake. We have a man like I. Navarre, who was a great Civil War land surveyor and civil engineer. And Oli Navarre, he laid out many of the farms and roads in our Manson and Lake Chelan area. And the old place out here on the lake where I think it's where Mac Cox lives, was that was the first homestead really first homestead, as I understand it, on the lake, and that was the Ie Navarre place. And we know the Navarre Peaks, they were named after Ie Navarre. Navarre came west after the Civil War and settled at Olympia. But he kept hearing these wonderful, wonderful things about the beautiful Lake Chelan area. And he had to investigate. He just had to come over here and see if it was all for real. And he came over and he liked what he saw and established himself here.
So. Didn't he go into cattle or something?
Yes, he was into cattle. And another man that was interested in cattle, and you know the old Powell place out on the lake here, that big old log house, that was built by Henry Colt of the Colt Firearms Company. He came out and established a fine cattle ranch there and raised horses and so forth. But that was one of the early day beautiful places on the lake, and that house was built, I think, in 18... I'm not sure. I think it was built in 1890. I could be off of 3 or 4 years, one way or the other. But he built that beautiful old log house, and it's just as solid today. It was the day that he built it. And the Pell family have lived for many years. We laugh and get talked about before they raised the lake. The doors on the house are Dutch doors. You know, they're half doors. You open the top part, and you've got a shelf to sit in. They said that they could sight their gun in on geese on the lake and shoot them with using the bottom half of the door as a gun rest. And that I thought that was kind of interesting too. The fact that happened. And on the Pell family, the Murners, Mrs. Pell was a Murner, and there was Mrs. Russell and a bunch of those Doc Russell family and so forth. They were early day people in here, and their history is a real story, too.
Dave, you mentioned Sanders and Dumke and getting the idea from the Indians to maybe put in a sawmill here. Why would the Indians have wanted them to settle here? Were they just being friendly, or were there a better reason?
The Indians here, the Chelan Indians, which are a sub-branch, I guess you'd say, of the Colvilles, they were a very, very friendly people, and they really welcomed these guys. They took them right in just like they were brothers, and I don't care, you name the Wapatos and the whole bunch, and I think there's some of the Wapato families, one of the finest families I think that we had had in our area. I had one man tell me many years ago that he worked for old John Wapato. That was the father of Peter Wapato. John Wapato had a trading post down at Ribbon Cliff, and when the earthquake came, it scared the dickens out of a lot of them, and they migrated up to where we have Wapato Point now.
Yeah, we should mention that was in the 1870s, I think.
Yes,
it was, and
that
it plugged the Columbia River.
Yeah,
so
it plugged up the Columbia River, I think, around 4 hours before it regained its course. Mm-hmm. And I could tell you an interesting story about that, but I don't know whether we got that much time, but about the earthquake and the...
Sure. Go ahead.
Well, when I first came here, now I don't know whether this is authentic or not, maybe the Indians would vouch for it.
Uh-huh.
But a friend of mine, Claude Norton, who his family lived for many years in Pateras and Chelan area, Claude later was assistant head of the Columbia Cotton Creek Company, but he said that in the early days, one of the Indians from the coast, the Salish Indians, were pursuing this bunch of Indians and to attack them and destroy them. And they came to the Columbia River. Now, This reads like the story in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And said that they got to this point on the Columbia River, and they were cornered.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, this earthquake happened, and they escaped over into Douglas County, across on this tremendous slide that filled the river. But by the time the other Indians caught up with them, now this was told to me and. Mm-hmm. And in honesty, I know whether it's true or not, I don't know.
Yeah.
That by the time these other Indians caught up to them, the Columbia River had regained its flow and sealed off the enemies from attacking them. But this was this was told to me many years ago. And then shortly after this, because of the earthquake, as I understand it, John Wapato, who maintained pack animals, he went even so far as Fort Astoria, but he went down to the fort that below Toppenish there at Fort Simcoe, and he went to Vancouver and many places there to He had the pack string running back supplying things. And Granville Wooten, who was an early day pioneer, the family were early day pioneers on Howard Flat and up in Washington Creek area. The Wooten family told many things about it. But Granville said when he was just a teenage boy, he worked for John Wapato, hoeing potatoes and working in the garden area out at Manson. And Granville told me that, and he's been gone many years yeah. now. The Wooten is an old name in the
in the
valley here, though, a very old name in the valley. Sure. But I thought that was kind of interesting. Here was a white man working for an Indian businessman, entrepreneur, as you want to, whatever you want to call it. John Wapato was a great, great man, as was Peter Wapato, his son. And there was two boys, you know, well-known of the Wapato family. Of course, there was a number of girls, too, but they were... Wapato people were beautiful people.
We're talking this morning with Dave Franklin about the history of the Lake Chelan Valley. Dave has been a longtime fan of local history, and we'll come back and talk some more with Dave in just a moment. Mentioned earlier in our conversation was Ben Smith, and he is a fellow that we have not done a great deal of talking about in our month of heritage. Can you tell us a little bit about his family and who he was?
Well, they're... Ben came here in the early days, and I believe it was out of Minnesota, but Ben came in here, and he was looking for pretty near everybody that first came in here were interested maybe in the mining deal. And this old butte up here, I think there must have been over 600 claims at one time filed on it. But when they saw the area here, now Ben Smith was one of the first people to plant apple trees here, and he saw the potential in the... The area was, the soil and everything was just right for raising apple trees. Well, Ben had a place on south of Chelan, on the south side of the lake down here, just down below the bridge down there. And he had two sons, Roy Smith and Park Smith. Park went into the apple business in real detail. All this area that Peterson has over here, that was all part of the Smith orchards in the early days. And they had a big steam plant and a steam pump that they irrigated that whole mountainside with water from the lake. Roy Smith, the son, went into the hardware business, and he married a girl from the Houston family. And the Houstons were real... Well, Houston was an early day school teacher in here, wonderful man. I met him in 1932 and knew him till I think he passed away in 36 or 37. But he was quite a wealthy man, this Mr. Houston. He'd saved his money and invested it wisely, and he did real well. But his son, Roy Smith, had owned what was the Valley Hardware for many years. It was Smith Hardware when I knew it, and... And then later it was sold, and there was such guys as, I think it was Bob Vogler and Glenn Harper and so forth, bought it during the last of the wars, I think it was the last of World War II, and operated then as the Valley Hardware. And it was just the Chelan Hardware, which the Kellys owned. That was owned by the Jim Reed family, and they came up here from Kennewick and started that hardware store many years ago, right in a location right where the post office building sits.
I think Ben Smith was also involved in some of the attempts in the 1890s and maybe even early 1900s to bring electric power into the area. Too,
yes, yeah, this is true. And there was M.M. Kingman and George Brown. Mm-hmm. George Brown and that group, they built a big flour mill at Chelan Falls. Also, they built a hydroelectric plant, and there was a small hydroelectric plant at the foot of the lake, the outflow of the lake. That was before they raised the lake. They just had some footboards in there, and it was a small plant. Mm-hmm. L.V. Harper, an uncle of Glenn Harper, was the first, as I understand, the first superintendent of that plant when it was in operation. Mm-hmm. But did you ever wonder where the money came from that built that power plant?
Believe it or not, I was going to ask you about that kind of thing.
Well, M.M. Kingman, the father of Kenny Kingman and Keith Kingman, were mining people, and they were doing a lot of prospecting up in the Horseshoe Basin area, and they had two or three mines up there, and a group came in and purchased that, and if I remember right, it was either $30,000 or $40,000, but mm-hmm. that $40,000 or whatever it was built the first power plant on the lower end of the lake. Well, then the Great Northern Railroad, I believe it was, or Minneapolis-St. Paul, I think it was then known, they had water rights, power rights on the lake. And they sold out the power rights to the Washington Water Power Company, who in 1927 and 28 built a hydro plant at Chelan Falls and built a dam here. And I think, if I remember right, going back in history, the total cost of the power plant, the dam, and the clearing of the lake was $10 million. I think that was the total cost. And that power plant down in Chelan Falls, they tell me, is probably the most efficient power plant in the world. It generates more power with two turbines. At one time, it generated more power than all of Rock Island did with all the turbines it had. But you see, the difference was it was high fall of water. There was, as I remember it, there's some 960,000 pounds pressure, almost a million pounds pressure per square inch against those Johnson valves in the power plant down at Chelan Falls. And it was a tremendously efficient plant. The water dropped some 400 feet from the lake into those turbines at Chelan Falls.
Well, that was certainly the sales pitch anyway back in the 1890s even when Laughlin McLean and DeWitt Britt started the newspaper business. How about Laughlin McLean? He's a name that does not come up in conversation with old-timers, but he was one of, as far as I can tell at least, the earliest real financier that tried to develop this area.
Well, I'm not too familiar with McLean. I think that this was the family out here at Manson John, there's up and out of Tenasket. I know that he was involved there in one of the last Indian wars. Battles was fought up that McLean Canyon. But why can't I think of this Green? He was head of that banking company for many, many years. It was Puget Sound Banking Company, and he had so much to do with it, but I can't really tell you too much about McLean.
Well, I know that at the time that DeWitt Britt came here in 1891, McLean was in Spokane.
Yes.
And had some money. He bought Chelan Falls, and then sent Britt here to operate a newspaper, which was geared primarily to selling that land. Britt was also the insurance agent and the real estate agent. But
Have you heard about the establishment of the town of Chelan Falls, how that came into being? This goes back to George Brown, and he came out of, he was the brother, or the father of Marshall Brown. The Brown family, Phil Brown and Joe Brown, the grandsons, they came out from the east, and he homesteaded all the land that's now Chelan Falls. 360 acres was the total involvement, as I remember. I interviewed Marshall Brown, the son, who was a financier and involved in many things. I interviewed him and took a three-hour interview off of him and Lillian Vernon, who was his sister. You probably remember the name Lillian Vernon. They lived out here in Spader's Bay, the old Vernon home where Tom Vernon lives now. And Marshall Brown told me that he was going to the University of Washington, and he said that his father didn't know beans about apples, but he brought in all these varieties of apples from Iowa and set them out. And as I understand it, the last tree of that original set out died 3 years ago, of these trees that they brought from Iowa and from the back in the Midwest. But he farmed all that area of Chelan Falls. And Marshall said if it hadn't been for him having the knowledge, learning about apples, it would have been a failure. But he took over when he was 18 years old. He came back from the University of Washington, took over the operation of the Brown Orchards. And they grew into a considerable, as you know, one of the biggest apple orchards in our area.
That's an interesting point because, as I understand it, in the 1890s, it was not assumed by any means that apples would be the big crop here. There were lots of other things that people tried too, weren't there?
No. They always thought that mining was going to be a big deal, and then later they thought that lumbering was trees. Now, believe it or not, there used to be a lot of trees on the north side of the lake. In the area out around Green's Landing, that was heavily, heavily timbered. Don Mather's brother, Gene Mather's, told when they cut those trees down and they got into trouble with the Bureau of Indian Affairs because this was Indian land. And they had those trees all decked out to haul them down to the sawmill. This is a long time ago, believe me. And the Bureau of Indian Affairs put a freeze on those trees and they lay there till they rotted. They would not let them utilize, as the story was told to me by Gene Mather's, they wouldn't let them utilize all those downed trees. They were all ready to be floated down lake to the sawmill and cut up. But the government said because they had been illegally cut that they would just lay there, and they did.
Let's talk a little bit about the way in which much of the land here came to pass out of an Indian reservation status and into being on the open market.
Well, as you probably know it, there was one time there was a reservation called the Columbian Indian Reservation. You probably have heard that, haven't you? And the Columbian Indian Reservation ran to the top of Stevens Pass. It ran to within about, 2 miles of the Canadian border on the north, the Columbia River on the east, and it took in that area of Nighthawk and Palmer Lake and all that area up there. And the development up in that area was brought on by mining. Nighthawk and all that area in there, Palmer Lake, there was many mines established there. But they said that the mining men, which I don't know how true this was, but it's been told to me many times, that they were so opposed to the Indians because they wanted to get into this mining deal that every time they caught an Indian out where nobody could see them, they shot them. Well, this went on for quite a while, and finally the Indians petitioned. One of them was Chief Moses. They petitioned to be a part of the Colville Reservation and joined in. Now, the Indians in our area had a choice of either moving to the reservation or
the Colville Reservation.
Yes, okay. Or taking an allotment on the lake. Now, the Wapato family all took allotments. The Eustis family, the Abrahams, Francis Abraham's family, they all took allotments on the lake. And in fact, this allotment from the Camel Hotel clear around there was one, was what we call the Long Jim allotment. And there's a story in itself. Long Jim was one of the finest Indians that we ever had in this area. He's a man of 6'4" height, a very experienced man in horses and so forth. Anybody wanted to buy a horse, go talk to Long Jim. He can tell you whether that horse is any good or not.
He's one of my favorite characters, and I know very little about him. So let's talk about him, but first let's take a commercial break, and then we'll come back and chat about Long Jim.
time. We went up there and...
Thank you very much. And we have returned to the crockery with Dave Franklin. Dave, we left talking about Long Jim. Tell me about him.
Well, Long Jim was a very knowledgeable man, a handsome, handsome man. He stood, well, I think they said about 6'4", and he was a lean, hard-built man, and he knew an awful lot about horses. We used to have a racetrack here for many years out here. Well, this Long Jim Hill going out toward Manson as you leave the town of Chelan up park, that was called Long Jim Hill. Mm-hmm. And Long Jim was, he supervised horse races. Indians always loved horse races. They loved good horse flesh, and they'd bet, and in the Indian stick games, they'd really gamble on horses and so forth. Well, anyway, Long Jim, Don Mathers told me an interesting anecdote about Long Jim. He said when he was just a boy, he said, I think he and Ab Garten was down fishing at the outflow of Lake Chelan. This was before the dam was built, you see. And he said, oh, Long Jim, even back in those days, was an expert fly fisherman. And he said, they were down there swimming and having a good time, just messing around. And he said that Long Jim made a cast in the willows on the outflow of the lake. He hung his fly up in the willows. And he said he was in a boat, Long Jim was, just anchored out there, fly fishing. And Don Mathers said, I climbed up in the willows, was just a kid, and unhooked his fly and tossed it back to him. And he said, forever after, he said, whenever Long Jim would see him or any place, he'd walk up, put around his arm around him. Don's my boy. Uh-huh. Don, good boy, he said. Don's my boy. And he said, that man, the respect of Long Jim, he said, meant so much to him as a kid to think that this guy was this kind of a man. Mm-hmm. Then I've heard people up at Maxine Ballou, who lives in Leavenworth, her father owned a general store at Brewster in the early days, and she said they just thought Long Jim was one of the finest people. He said he stopped at their place. He would never sleep in the house. You know, they'd come through with a party, he'd always sleep in the barn, but they were good tillicums, good yeah. friends, see, real good friends.
Was there not a court decision that involved some pretty extensive precedent that surrounded Long Jim and his land or something like that at one point?
Well, yes, yes, there was. But as I understand it, they finally allowed Long Jim to sell off much of his land. I think Camel Hotel probably sits on a portion of that land. I know that it went all around the lake and took in all of Spader's Bay and up to the top of the hill. You see, they were allowed, I believe it was 160 acres under this mm-hmm. under this allotment plan. And then, of course, the Wapato Point was another allotment. That was the Wapato family, and there was many problems brought on by the Peter Wapato's brother and mm-hmm. so forth. They finally Joe Creek area. That was all part of an Indian allotment. And one time there was a fence rent dividing the land out at Manson. It was one side of this fence was white man's territory. The other side belonged to the Indians. You see, I mean this was Indian land and Indian property, and they put a dividing fence so there wouldn't be any chance of people encroaching either way on
border disputes that way.
Yeah, on their rights, yeah. And then there's sometime, I don't think I should talk about now, but sometime the famous Indian trial I don't know whether you've ever heard about the famous Indian trial at Chelan County Courthouse over a death that happened among the Indians, but I think maybe I should wait till the last...
One area that I did want to cover with you today is, and you just mentioned it during one of our commercial breaks, but your name and a few others of that people remember as business people, Bill Gurr and a few others, mm-hmm. Pop up in old newspapers in the baseball box scores, mm-hmm. and that would have been like the 1930s.
Yes.
Did you play a lot of baseball in those days?
Yes, I played quite a lot of baseball, and my brother, Fat or Erlin mm-hmm. Franklin over here, he played third base for baseball team for many, many, or for several years here. And then we had a One time we had a Mr. Pennington who owned Chelan Electric, Auto Electric Company here, and he had a baseball team called Pennington's Droppers. Now, we weren't, we didn't think we were selfish professionals, but we played many, many baseball games. My father was a minister here in town. He caught behind the bat. My brother Doc played first, DeLance, so he's a professor for many years at the University of Idaho. He played first base, and I played second base. My brother Fat played third base, and was Leonard Waddell, played out in the outfield, and later my brother Wes, who was killed over in Germany in World War II, he played shortstop. He later was signed up at Portland in the Coast League, and he never got to really play any baseball because he was sent overseas and was killed, but never got back. But we always thought that Wes was going to be a big league ball player. He had a pistol of an arm, and
you guys pretty much had the infield covered then, didn't you?
Yeah. I played outfield. It depended on, we had guys like Ab Garten. Ab was a terrific baseball player. That's Art's older brother. Art Garten was about the sneakiest pitcher. I don't mean sneaky in the fact that he was a sneaky guy, but he outsmarted the batter. Art was just kept the batter off balance. He never knew what was coming next. And Art later managed Chelan Legion to the state championship Legion baseball. And he was a
When you guys played ball, was it for the Chelan town team?
I played some for the town team, and then I also played for the. We had 10 baseball teams in this area at one time. Beebe had a ball team. The DeMolay had a good ball team made up of kids of DeMolay's age, 14 to, we'll say, 18 years of age.
Yeah.
And we had, there was a couple of teams at Chelan Falls, and Chelan Falls had a good baseball team. One time I played for them, and we played in this Up Valley League, and we used to go to Winthrop and Twisp and Brewster and so forth, and we had that was the most fun that you can think of, because the women folks down there in Chelan Falls would cook up a batch of chicken and make tater salad and maybe the guys would bring along a few cases of homebrew, and we'd head for Winthrop or Twisp, and we'd have a ball game, and we'd have a big picnic lunch, and times were so tough that we'd take a big old flatbed truck loaded up. We didn't take any cars. We just took an old flatbed truck and proceeded to the baseball game, and it was really a holiday spirit. I can't tell you how much fun it was, but it was really fun to go out with a bunch of people like that, and we were all real close, and, we visited a lot.
With that many ball clubs, was it hard to find space to practice and play on and so on?
No, we had an old ball field originally down by where the ball fields are now.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Bob Little and the Griffith brothers, and I was trying to think who all, they owned all this land out here where the trailer, travel trailer park is. That was a racetrack. And they gave that to the city, and was to be used as a rodeo grounds and a baseball field.
Mm-hmm.
When I came here, that we had a big grandstand there and shoots for rodeo. We put on a rodeo every year. Mm-hmm. Guys like Dick Warden and Ellie Radley and those guys used to have these things up, and we'd put on a big rodeo every year. Got bringing guys from Canada and all over the Northwest to put on a rodeo. But we had that good baseball field. We home plate was back about, well, pretty close to where the office is out there at the trailer park, and we batted toward the hill, toward the road going out to Manson. That was where the outfield was, and we used to have, there was a ball game every night in the summertime there.
Was it a big thing for spectators to come and watch the baseball games?
People turned out that, and everybody had their favorite team or their favorite players. I know my dad, being a minister, he wouldn't play on Sunday, but there was guys like M. Garten and old Judge Chatfield and old Jake, Easley, lived down on Howard Flat, had a big ranch on Howard Flat. They'd come and sit behind home plate and razz my dad because he was a minister, and he could take it pretty well. I mean, he was a person that enjoyed having people kind of picking on him. It was all in fun, you know. But we used to have so darn much fun those baseball games there.
You know, there's another guy, a local fellow, who I've always been interested in. He helped organize the fire department, get the first fire truck. He was a very successful businessman, a great photographer, and that was Bill Gurr, also a baseball player.
Bill is, I can't say enough about Bill. I loved that man as much, probably almost as I did my father, because Bill and I hunted together. We used to go down to Yakima pheasant hunting, and we used to go up in the reservation bird hunting together, and I really thought a world of that man, and he was so public spirited. I mean, he always ready to help somebody. And I can remember that they used to play baseball games out on Washington Creek, out in the you go back up Washington Creek, way back up to the alders and so up there, and there was a big flat deal. They used to have a big 4th of July celebration every day with homemade ice cream and so forth, and people would come in their buggies and horses and horseback and so forth, and a tremendous crowd there. And but Bill was had been a U.S. Marshal up in Alaska before he came to Washington. His father was an Episcopal priest, and he was one of the early day pastors of the St. Andrew's Episcopal Church here. And they had built a home in up out of Ketchikan, Alaska. Bill told me this. I got it all on tape, but he told me about they had this. They built this home there, and then his dad came down and took over the pastorate of this Episcopal church, and I think that was around 1890, if I remember reading my history. And Bill went back to, I believe it was Minneapolis, and learned the watch repair business, and came back and started a watch repair place in Chelan. Well, Bill had been a U.S. Marshal, and he served as a deputy sheriff. Whenever they always said whenever they had a real tough character they weren't brought in, they'd say, Bill, go get him. And I've asked Bill about this a number of times, but Bill always had this tone of authority about him that didn't permit anybody to question whether he had that authority. He'd say, well, Joe or whoever it was, he said, I come out, I want you to go with me. We're going down so-and-so. And the guy said, well, I don't want to go. Noel, Bill says, that hasn't anything to do with it. I have to. It's my responsibility to break you in. And he said, it's just all there is to it. We have to do this. And he was, I would say, he was his manner, his mien was so convincing that I don't think he ever had to really get rough with anybody to bring him in. But I've heard and during World War I, draft evaders being involved in with the federal marshals and bringing in people that refused to sign up for the DAF or when their name was called to appear for induction, see. But Bill told me a lot about that, and an incident up here on Johnson Avenue where the guys sneaked out and crawled up a canyon, and Bill had them figured about where they'd come out of the canyon, and he was there waiting for them when they came out.
Sounds like a fascinating man. Dave, we've already been here for over an hour, and it's just really zipped by. Any particular areas or people that you want to mention before we wrap it up for today?
Well, I always thought real highly of the Varney families. The Varney families and the Ward families in the early days, they were related. I mean, Len Ward and Harry Ward and so forth. And the Varneys, Lon Varney, Leonda, and Harry Varney were our early day builders, and some of our early day builders in here. They were expert workmen. Harry Varney was married to Melissa Kingman, and the Kingmans were early day people in there. They came out of, I believe, the Nebraska country, but I can't say enough about the Varney brothers. To me, they were just wonderful, wonderful gentlemen, and what they built was well built. Mm-hmm. They built a lot of the houses in the area. Don Mathers is one of my great, great friends. He and I visited many times. Beautiful man. He wrote much of the history of our early area, and he was in owned what's now the Builders Lumber Company for many years. A lot of the buildings on Main Street was built by Don Mathers. The old museum building, he remodeled that. Mm-hmm. And I could look up and down Main Street, and a number of those buildings were built by him, mm-hmm. Don Mathers. He became an accomplished electrician, a plumber, a carpenter, a brick mason. He learned all these through study, you see, mm-hmm. and he could pass those tests required to be that kind of a... He was all over an accomplished man, really, really an accomplished individual, Don Mathers was.
Everybody has their own story to tell in a small community, don't they? Mm-hmm. There's so many interesting people.
Yes, there is. Yeah. There is. A lot of very interesting people in this area. Dave Carell was one of the most interesting men that I know of. Dave Carell came in here. He was a... How much time have you...
Well, we're fine. Go ahead.
Dave Carell came in here from the Yakima area, but he had been the sheriff at Goldendale for many years when gold was discovered at Virginia City and up at Pierce, Idaho. And there was many, many real evil people that came in with a gold rush, you know, cutthroats, murderers, thieves, mm-hmm. you name it. And they always said, I read a book some years ago, Early Days in the Klickitat, and they said that Dave Carell had to kill some 15 men in the line of duty. Mm-hmm. And I know that at Yakima one time in one of the saloons there, three men came in to kill old Dave Carell, and one of them wounded him creased his skull, and he thought he'd killed him dead. And Dave knocked down, he was helping out Tenon Bar, the old Alaska saloon in Yakima. It's still there. Mm-hmm. And he finally came to, and he figured out where these guys were, and he shot two of them, killed one, and put the other in the hospital for a couple months. And he was seriously wounded. He got hit in one hip, and he stayed in St. Elizabeth Hospital for quite a while. But then he came north in 1890, as I remember it, and settled down on Howard Flat. Homesteaded out there. Mm-hmm. The airport is all part of Dave Carell's land. And he was the first orchardist out in on that area. He planted apples that you don't even hear about anymore. Mm-hmm. Arkansas Blacks, Wealthies, Ben Davis, mm-hmm. many Michigan Spy, I think it is, and so forth. But many apples that you don't ever hear anymore about. But Dave one time, Dave was a big man. And he's buried up in the cemetery next to my wife's grandfather in the cemetery up on the hill. And one time, Dave was a tremendous poker player. George Garton told me about his ability. He was a strictly square poker player, but boy, he was shrewd. You got in a poker game with old Dave Carell, you were in a poker game. And one time, there was one of these card sharks came in, and Dave caught him cheating. And right down about where the Ruby Theater is, or about where your radio mm-hmm. antenna station is, Dave picked up this guy and threw him through the plate glass window. And he told him, he says, don't you ever come back. So the man, needless to say, didn't come back. He got the heck out of town. But I've heard from Art Garton and George Garton and some of the old timers tell about Dave Carell. One of the most interesting incidents, I think, happened out here on Howard Flat. Granville Wooten was having trouble with a man over water rights, and the man told Granville, he says, Granville, if I ever catch you down around this spring again, he says, I'm gonna stomp the hell out of you. And Granville says, well, no, don't do anything rash now. And anyway, he went up to Dave Carell's place, and he says, Dave, have you got a gun? And Dave says, nope. He says, it's in the top drawer of that chest over there. But he said, nope, I don't have a gun. Granville said he went over and got this old .44 Colt. And he said the next morning when he went down to the spring, why, this man came down and, oh, he says, here you are again. He says, well, I guess you're asking for it. I'm going to stomp you. And he says, I had a coat on. He said, I had that gun tucked in my belt. Now he pulled it out, and I says, now what were you going to do to this man? And I won't tell you the man's name because the name is... And this fella backed off, and he says, now, Granville, don't do anything hasty. Don't do anything hasty. Well, Granville says, you leave me alone, or you'll get what's coming to you. And he said he went back to Dave Carell's place and walked in and put the gun back in the drawer where he found it. He says, thanks, Dave. Dave says, go to hell, Granville.
I think that's a fitting story to end on. We've had a marvelous time chatting with you this morning, and I want to thank you for taking the time out of your day to come and join us.
It was my pleasure, too.
Thank you very much. And we've been talking this morning with Dave Franklin, who's been interested in local history for a long time. Most enjoyable conversation this morning. That wraps it up for the month of Heritage. So let's go back to the studio.